This is Red Eyes Radio. Hi everyone, and welcome. You are listening to Red Eyes Radio. This is Henrik Palmgren, the editor of red-eyes.net, coming to you from the west coast of Sweden. I will be your host the following hour, and thank you everyone who has tuned in today, either through bbsradio.com or through the archives sometime in the future. As we usually do on this program, since it's only an hour short, we dive right into the topic and at hand and our guests. And we have a very special guest with us today. We have one of the authors to astrotheology and shamanism joining us. He is also one of the lecturers of the Pharmacratic Inquisition, a brilliant video lecture that very generously have been shared for free over at their site, gnosticmedia.com. Jan Irvin is his name, and as I said, he is the co-author together with Andrew Rutaji. And I do want to mention that we tried to get both Jan and Andrew on the show, but a combination of things, the time zone issue with me being up here in Sweden and them over there in the U.S., and the technology currently available in the studio has resulted in that we only can connect one phone, but I'm nonetheless very glad that John has joined us. So welcome to the program, John, and thank you for taking the time to be here.
You're welcome, Henrik, and thank you for having me on. Much appreciated.
Yeah, great. I want to mention right at the beginning here that I first looked at your video lecture that I mentioned earlier, the Pharmacratic Inquisition, about, I guess, 1.5 years ago, and I had come in contact with much of the research and work of Jordan Maxwell. And then on top of that, I saw the research that you guys have done, and the combination that happened there was really, for the lack of a better word, a revelation, and it basically blew my mind, and it's really brilliant. So thank you for putting it out there and making it available.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
It was a project that we originally, originally that video wasn't actually supposed to be released. It was done as a project to gain sponsorship so that we could finish the book, and then we had such a high demand for our research at the time that we ended up releasing the video anyway.
Ah, I see. Okay, and I should mention also that everyone listening who haven't seen this video lecture should, right after this show, head on over to Jan and Andrew's site, which again is gnosticmedia.com. And take a look at that. It's a 3.5 hour long presentation, and you don't want to miss that if you find some of the things that we'll be talking about here today interesting. So to start things off here, I think it's always interesting and a good way to start it at the beginning, so to speak. So it would be interesting to hear from you, Jan. How did you become involved in this kind of research, and how did you end up writing the book Astrotheology and Shamanism together with Andrew?
Well, the process sort of started out slow back in the early 90s. I had met with a fairly well-known author, especially here in the United States, named Jack Herer, who was the founder of the modern-day hemp movement, and he brought all of the knowledge about industrial hemp and medical marijuana and, the use of the plant as a viable, natural, renewable resource throughout history, and all of its information. And I had become friends with him in about 92, and he used to always tell me that religions were based on psychedelic drugs and star worship and things like that. And at the time I thought he was crazy, and he kept always pushing the ideas on me and giving me research to check out. Some of it I would read, some of it I took years to read, but eventually the idea captured my attention. I suppose in about 95 or 96, there was a Gathering of the Minds convention in Orange County that had a lot of speakers like Dennis McKenna and Timothy Leary and Bruce Eisner and Peter Stafford and a lot of the various researchers out there on the entheogenic community. And so that was what made me realize at that time that there was more to the idea of entheogens playing a major role in religion and everything that we consider in some aspect a reality. It suddenly started looking or appearing to play a far more important role in all of that. So coming forward from there, just over the years, beginning to dig further and further into the research and learning more and more about it, just kept opening up newer avenues of research that were actually older, and we realized at some point that we weren't uncovering anything new, that this was archaic information. And shamanism was very widespread, and so was archaeoastronomy, astrotheology, and just applying these ancient global ideas of time and drugs and plants and poisons and things like that made us realize that there was a global pattern that followed through shamanism and the knowledge of the stars that hadn't really been looked at directly combining the two before.
As you mentioned, what's his name? Jack Herer, I guess.
Yes.
His research was that about primarily about industrial hemp, I guess.
Yeah, and he, during his research on industrial hemp and the history of so-called marijuana and everything, he had come across the research of Gordon Wasson and John Allegro, and he had spent several years researching John Allegro's claims in The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross that Christianity was based on a psychedelic mushroom and sun and star worship. John Allegro wrote The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross in 1970, and it was widely marginalized, not accepted. But, there were a few people that did accept it and kept looking into it, and Jack had turned me onto the research in the early 90s, and I just kept digging into it, probing further and looking at a lot of the things that Allegro was saying, one thing that none of the other scholars would really want to talk about is an ahistoricity theory of Jesus and the biblical characters. Everybody accepts them as literal history. And John Allegro took them as allegory representing sun and star worship and drug references. And it's actually, it might seem sort of far-fetched at first, but the more you dig into it and look at other cultures and religions and how they formed, we look at Native Americans who use entheogens like peyote, and South Americans and Central Americans who used mushrooms and ayahuasca and had extensive knowledge of the cosmos and stars and galaxies and, the Mayan calendar measuring 18 different calendars that the Mayans had, measuring all different ratios of time and things like that. And so when we start putting into perspective all of these different cultures that use these substances and also had a great deal of knowledge for the heavens at night, obviously they didn't have city lights distorting the sky at night. It was a much more important role that taught them when to harvest and plant and store food and, the knowledge of the plants for healing and for enlightenment and for not only that, but for poisons and drugs, for warfare, et cetera, was very important knowledge that was passed down generation after generation, and that was the knowledge of the plants.
Yeah.
And we found a sort of coalescence between the two ideas that other scholars hadn't really combined, and the macrocosm, microcosm, as above, so below theories of religion, and started looking at those two as actually bringing together shamanic thought with astrotheological knowledge, and so that was the formation of our book.
Yeah, and for those who don't know, astrotheology, what does it mean?
Well, astro comes from the word star, or it's Latin star, and theo is God, and logi or logos is the word of the study of. So astrotheology is how the heavens and the stars and the sun were revered by ancient peoples as gods or deities. And then another concept that I mentioned a minute ago is archaeoastronomy.
Yeah.
And archaeo being ancient or past studies, ancient peoples, and astro or you know, archaeoastronomy, how ancient cultures used astronomy and how it affected those cultures. You know, and that could be everything from the creation of calendars and the measurement of time, the study of the precession of the equinoxes, lunar calendars, solar calendars, and sort of an encompassing base that spreads out into astrotheology, and then from there into what is today known as astrology, but we don't really get into the so-called predictions of astrology. You know, astrotheology stops at the deities and the meanings of the deities of the stars, instead of trying to interpret some predisposed prediction from them.
Yeah, and to tie this back here, if I'm correct here, was it John Allegro who was one of the three translators of the Dead Sea Scrolls? Isn't that right?
Well, he was a part of a team of, I think there was probably seven or eight of them, that was formed by, the team was formed by Father Joseph Millick. And he was the only non-Christian member of the Dead Sea Scrolls translators. And he had actually started out as a Methodist minister, but the further he got into studying languages, realized that it proposed more and more problems in his religious beliefs that that couldn't be answered from his theological studies. So he began to study ancient Sumerian, Akkadian, Aramaic, these ancient languages, Hebrew, etc., and started to notice that there were many correlations, you know, that if we're brought in together, proposed many different ideas, and he was sort of sparked simultaneously in the study of his work by a mycologist from the London London Museum of Botany or whatever.
Yeah, sure.
Dr. Ramsbottom, and at the same time, or actually sort of later, at Gordon Wasson's publication of Soma, and also Mushrooms, Russia, and History.
Yeah.
And so Allegro started looking at these ideas of other cultures that used psychedelics for religious purposes, and seeing if they fit into Christianity through language.
Interesting, and this, of course, ties back to the writings of the Bible, also with the thing called manna, right?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
You know, and what we talk about in our book is that there were likely two types of manna: the manna in the so-called desert that, you know, that the Jews fleeing Egypt found traveling the desert. And but what we found is, looking up that word, is that the word that's translated as wilderness or desert there is actually a cow pasture. or a field where cattle are driven, as Strong's Concordance translates it.
Hmm.
So suddenly, you know, instead of a desert, and a lot of people were having problems with the idea of Amanita muscaria, the red and white spotted mushroom bean manna, for that is reasonable, actually, because when we get in there and look at that word and see it as cow pasture, it would obviously become a psilocybe-based mushroom that would be the manna of the wilderness years. However, that would be a little bit different. We also mention in our book that there is the hidden manna, and we think that is, you know, the hidden manna mentioned in Revelation, and we think that is the Amanita muscaria that is found underneath the pine trees and coniferous trees, like we find the brightly colored packages underneath the Christmas tree at Christmas time.
Yeah, that is a fascinating connection, and you know, we could go, you know, in two directions here, I guess. And one, the first one, of course, is the correlation between Jesus and sun worship and of the winter solstice and so forth. And the other one is connecting Christianity and especially Christmas to the mushroom itself. And is there where do you want to go, so to speak?
Well, let's start with the astronomical aspects of the Jesus character.
Yeah.
If we think of Jesus as a sun character, just like Mithra and Horus and Krishna and Buddha before him as Acharya and Kersey Graves and Gerald Macy and many other researchers have put out, Manly Hall as well.
Yeah.
That these characters are all representations of the death and rebirth of the sun.
Yeah.
The sun is born on December 25th and begins heading north again 1 degree each day after December 25th. And December 25th should actually be considered the real New Year's Day, because that's the day that the sun, as I just mentioned, begins heading north again. Days are actually degrees. Each day is a degree of the movement of the sun across the sky. And so what we have is actually from the summer solstice, typically around June 21st, from the summer solstice, the sun falls into the fall or autumn 1 degree each day towards the south. If we were to look east out our window every morning, we would notice that each day the sun rises on the horizon 1 degree closer to the south.
Yeah.
And but what happens is the sun doesn't immediately bounce back on December 25th. On the winter solstice, December 21st, the sun actually stops or is said to be in a tomb for 3 days. The sun doesn't rise over the horizon. It's not 1 degree further south or to the north for 3 days. It's in the same position, so it's dead. The sun is in a tomb.
Yeah.
And on the morning of December 25th, the sun starts its trek 1 degree back towards the north again for the next 6 months. And then the cycle repeats itself. Excuse me. So with this cycle, inside the cycle, there's other things that we consider in the ancient mythological religious tales about the wise men or the three wise men. And, the three wise men being the belt of Orion. And, you know, as the Christmas song goes, westward leading, still preceding, not following. So preceding is something that comes before.
Yeah.
And so the three wise men are actually preceding the sun, God's son, to be born on the morning of December 25th, the sun in the sky.
Yeah.
And so the three wise men point to the exact place on the horizon where the sun will rise, you know, on the evening of December 24th. The three wise men point down to where the sun will rise early in the morning on December 25th. But before the sun rises, another thing also happens in the sky, and that is Virgo, where the three wise men point to is actually the star Sirius will come up over the horizon if you continually follow the line down from the Belt of Orion or the Three Wise Men, what happens is this place that the Three Wise Men point to in alignment with the star Sirius is exactly where the sun is born underneath the constellation Virgo, the Virgin's legs. So we have the astronomical tale of the sun being born of a virgin, the constellation Virgo, on December 25th. And so that's, you know, where this tale is founded in is astrotheological knowledge.
Yeah.
And 9 months before the sun is born on December 25th, we celebrate something called Easter. And Easter is the inception of the sun 9 months later. And we know when it's Easter by waiting for the spring equinox, which is typically March 20th or 21st. And then we wait for the first full paschal moon, and then Easter falls on the following Sunday.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's, you know, and then 9 months later, the sun is born on December 25th, and the cycle repeats itself.
Yeah, yeah. And I know that you guys mentioned in your lecture about Constantine and the Council of Nicaea, and I find it interesting because, you know, allegedly there was previous to Christianity, there was Rome had the Mithra worship and other sun deities. And do you think that it's just a, you know, a translation of that applied to the creation of the Jesus myth, so to speak, or what do you think
well,
is about?
Yeah, basically, at the, you know, what we feel is that at the Council of Nicaea, the bishops and scholars of the world got together and they created what is now called the Catholic, or Catholic actually means universal church.
Yeah, yeah.
And they brought together over 300 of the world's leading religious scholars at the time, and from Hindu and Vedic and Zoroastrian and Judaic and, you know, you name it.
Yeah.
And you know, basically canonized the story, created the what is called the Nicene Creed, which is basically just a list of what Christians are to believe and hold true as far as Christ. And you know, they're all things that are taken from other prior religions based on this sun worship tale.
Yeah. And of course, this you mentioned earlier terms as you know, precession and the age of Aquarius, of course, which you theorize in your lecture that the representation here of the Jesus story is basically about the Piscean age, or the age of Pisces, and now, of course, we are going into the next phase. Maybe if you can, you could talk a little bit about you know, just precession and how do you know how it works?
Well, the precession of the equinox is something that's not talked about often enough. Outside of our solar year, which lasts 365 days, there is a great year that most people don't even know exists, and that is called the precession of the equinoxes. And one trip through the precession of the equinoxes takes 25,800 years and is broken down into 12 segments, just like the zodiac is broken into 12 segments.
Yeah.
Called the that are called ages. So the zodiac has its monthly procession or moving forward through the animal constellations, but on the precession of the equinoxes, it actually moves backward through the constellations. And what that means is that if you measure at the spring equinox, where the sun rises directly to the east, every year it's slightly off. It's you know, it doesn't raise quite in the same place. And so what happens is over 25,800 years, there is a backward rotation through the zodiac, where the sun rises at the spring equinox.
Yeah.
And so in various ancient cultures, this knowledge was well known and observed. Some argue at least 1,000 years before Christianity, but we think it goes much further back than that.
Mm.
There's a wonderful book out called Hamlet's Mill that goes into the history of the precession of the equinoxes. What we found, and which concurs with Acharya S. and Jordan Maxwell and a lot of the other researchers, is that this age that the sun is born in, and it's each of the 12 periods or ages is 2,150 years. So this division of 12, the ages, would be a macrocosmic representation to our monthly zodiac sign, or, you know, it's basically a 30-day month is a small representation of this huge month in the heavens, which lasts 2,150 years in age.
Yeah.
And so if we go far enough back and we look at the age of Apis, the bull, and the bull symbolism in Hinduism, it's a little over 6,000 years ago, and that's the age of Taurus. And then we move 2,150 years, and these ages are approximate. They're not divided evenly because the zodiac signs aren't matched by perfect degrees of separation. So going 2,150 years forward, we reach the age of Aries, and the Jews blow the shofar, the ram's horn, in honor of the ram, and Moses had the ram's horns on his head, which were symbolic of Aries, and that has sort of been misadopted as a symbol for so-called devil worship, but that was actually just a symbol for sun worship under the age of Aries, the ram.
Yeah.
And then you travel another 2,150 years forward and into the age that we're currently ending is the Piscean Age, and the Piscean Age is the symbol of the two fish. Jesus was the fisher of men. He fed the masses with two fish, and so this is the symbolism where the fisher iconography comes from. You know, it's strictly astrotheologically related, know, as well as fish have symbolism in regard to fertility, and the ancient cultures held fertility in very high regard. So and then presently we're entering the age of Aquarius, which mythologically speaking is the age where all of the ancient knowledge is returned back to the masses of the people. They will understand the history of the religions at their face value and what they were intended to mean and teach us.
And is this the, I don't know if we can say this, but isn't this the last sign in the full, as we go full circle, so to speak, Aquarius?
Well, yeah, but, you know, to go into, you know, a pseudoscientific discussion of whether or not it ends or the cycle repeats or whatever, that's not something that we can prove as of now.
Of course.
You know, that's something that we can only know at the time that it comes, which, you know, some people say it's 2012, which we talk about in our book.
And
the beginning of the Aquarian Age varies up to 150 to 200 years simply because of the variation in degrees in the separation of the zodiac signs.
Exactly. And what are your thoughts on that? I know in your lecture you call it the Aquarian initiation, right?
It's just, you know, an idea that we put out. You know, we don't really have any ideas as to what would come about of it other than we suggest that it's your own personal awakening of this type of knowledge, or, you know, basically masses understanding this type of information and religious history.
Yeah, and I think we can see it.
No longer accepting it. Sorry about that. No longer accepting it as at face value as a literal history.
Yeah, exactly.
Of people running around in the Middle Eastern deserts.
Yeah, yeah, and I think we can see. We can see it happen, I think. You know, I think there are more and more people waking up to this, and of course, your work contributes greatly to that, I think. So keep it up. It's great. And
thank you.
Yeah, to connect this back, you know, I haven't yet read the book. I haven't. I should get myself a copy, and I read. I don't get the time to read as much as I'd like to these days. But is the video lecture? Is it like a short version of your book, or do you go off into any specific other directions in the book?
Well, the book is definitely based on a lot of information in the video, but it's probably, I would say the video contains about 20 to 25% of the information found in the book. We definitely go into a lot more history in detail, and we provide a huge amount of footnotes and references into our research that we just weren't able to do in the video.
Yeah.
You know, and as I mentioned before, the video was never really meant for public release. It was to gain sponsorship, and so there are just to let your listeners know, a few errors in the video that we have an error list that can be found on the website that I recommend everybody interested in reading the error list. It's not too long. It's nothing that affects the overall core of the research, but there's just some few minor errors in there that we mention for clarification.
Yeah, sure. And we touched briefly upon 2012, and there's a lot of noise, and the drum is beating louder and louder by the day, it seems. And this, of course, as you said, is the end of the Mayan calendar. There's different theories exactly when it ends and so forth, but basically around 2011, 2012, going over to 2013. And I mean, what, do you have any ideas? I mean, that there are so many thoughts that there is a catastrophe coming, and there is a lot of different ideas. And what's your take on it?
I don't like to. I'm not a prophet. I don't like to get into predictions of what 2012 will bring, if anything.
Yeah.
And I've seen the research of people like Ian Lungold, and who based his research off of Carl. I think it was Carl Coleman.
Yeah, that's right.
Trying to make all of these predictions that, a year and a half ago, I saw Ian Lungold's lecture before he died out in Los Angeles. And he made these predictions that free energy would be public knowledge, and we would all be beginning to receive free energy by last summer. Clearly that information is not mainstream public. We're paying, up to, in California, up to the highest gas prices ever, nothing compared to Europe. I used to live over there, too.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Indeed.
But, we're paying the highest gas prices ever, and, I don't like to get into that whole prophecy sort of thing. There's no reason for it, and just to put speculation on something, nobody can say for sure what's going to happen.
No, of course not.
Terrence McKenna had his time wave zero theory. There are many other ideas, and a lot of them make a lot of sense, and they're interesting to ponder, but do they hold merit? Only 2012 will tell.
It will, indeed. Yeah, of course. And we can go into a little bit, I think, to the more of the connection to the entheogens and the Christian and Christmas connection to the mushroom, and to get things going here. How did you get this idea, so to speak? Was it based on some other research, or did you guys discover this, the mushroom Christianity connection?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, John Marco Allegro, he was the first researcher to take a serious look at Christianity being based on entheogens or psychedelics, and he wrote a book in 1970 called The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. And academia pretty much broadly dismissed it, and in fact there was a letter that came out in the London Times by 14 scholars no more than a week after the book had gone to print, stating that they had thoroughly researched the book and found it to hold no merit whatsoever, and, you know, yada yada. But one problem that we found is that, you know, the book was published in May of 1970, and these 14 scholars' review came out within a week of the publication of the book, but the book contained over 150 pages of footnotes, references to other very well-known scholarly books and sources. So for even 14 people to go through that much material in a week and write and publish a letter to the Times just was an impossible time. It just was impossible. They didn't give his research due credit. And as I mentioned earlier, Allegro was the only non-Christian member of the Dead Sea Scrolls translation team. And all of the other members were, except for one who was working at a different seminary, all of them were Catholic priests. Except for Allegro, who trained in the Methodist ministry and then left because of his studies in languages. So Allegro was the first one that brought up the idea, and since he had brought it up in purely linguistic analysis, we decided to approach it from the symbolism and some of the other aspects of religious history that Allegro didn't tie in. And I want to mention that Allegro took a lot of heat for other things that that he wasn't actually to blame for, and one of those being that he misquoted the effects and taste and everything of the mushroom. But he had quoted Professor Ramsbottom from the London Botany Museum. And these were direct quotes from this person's research and not misstatements on Allegro's part. And a lot of people accused Allegro of stealing Gordon Wasson's research. He actually based most of his research on this mycologist Ramsbottom, and in fact it was not based on Wasson's work. Somebody's calling in. I'm going to ignore that.
I was wondering about that. And of course, you mentioned in your lecture about James Arthur, and he's kind of course, he's passed away now. I think he passed away in April last year, sometime. And he is what is known as an ethnomycologist also, and he was the one who. I remember a few shows I heard on Jeff Wren's program with James Arthur, where he also connected the Christmas story to the mushrooms, and I always enjoyed his shows that he used to do with Jeff. And have you guys picked up on his work also?
Yeah, well, I'm very familiar with his research, and I agree with a lot of it. The problem with his research is that he was vehemently against providing thorough sources in his material. So he was attacked a lot for, you know, for things like plagiarism and just, you know, having unfounded research because he didn't provide sources. And I think most of his research is pretty solid, but it takes a lot of digging and years worth of reading to go through much of the material that he had gone through to substantiate some of the ideas that he was claiming. So, you know, it's his research had its problems and its merits, but you know, he definitely contributed a lot to the field of ethnomycology, and especially in Christianity.
And his, you know, I guess his more of his basic ideas was, you know, based upon. I know. Remember the shows that he did that he showed the symbology in the old the Christmas the old pictures of Christmas and New Year's Eve with you know elves with mushroom hats and so forth. And I know that you guys also have a lot of pictures in your lecture there, and they're really they're fascinating, and it's really it's pretty also, of course. But what do you think? Do you think that this is some kind of, you know, communication about this, or is this just the myths passing down through the generations without us knowing about it?
Well, maybe some of both. But you know, first I wanted to mention that it was originally Dr. Patrick Harding out of the University of Manchester who was the first to bring the Christmas mushroom information to light. And throughout the 90s, he would travel throughout England and especially London around Christmas time and do talks about the Amanita muscaria mushroom and the history of Christmas. And then James Arthur, I believe, had caught on to that research either through a book called The Physics of Christmas by James Highfield or through Harding's later publication, which I think came out in 2000 or 2001. He was probably the first to really go public and talk about the information, but the last to really publish it.
Mm.
And, you know, so there was a lot of research out there already existing on the history of Christmas being a derivative of ancient Siberian and Norse shamanism.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of the obvious symbols that we have for Christmas being related to shamanism is the Christmas tree and where the bright red and white Amanita muscaria mushroom grows. It only grows under coniferous trees like the pine and other trees like the birch.
Yeah.
But this mushroom is the brightly colored packages that appear magically overnight underneath the Christmas tree. And, of course, the Christmas tree is actually the world tree, which is symbolic of the world axis.
Yeah.
And, you know, the shaman were worshiping the death and rebirth of the sun at the winter solstice when they would take these substances at so-called Christmas time.
Mm.
And, you know, so the tree contained the brightly colored packages that would appear overnight that the, you know, that the shaman would eat. And of course we have the mythology like the Norse Odin and the goats pulling his chariots, just like Santa Claus and the flying reindeer.
Yeah.
It's very well documented that Siberian shaman are reindeer herders, and reindeer's favorite food happens to be the Amanita muscaria mushroom.
Ah.
So, you know, we have this whole symbology of flying reindeer and you know, pulling Santa, the chubby guy dressed in red and white, who is the anthropomorphism of the mushroom itself.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the ties to astrotheology there with the world tree and the pine tree, macrocosm and microcosm, which is also represented, as we show in our book and the video, the Yggdrasil tree, the as above, so below theme.
Yeah. And do you think, you know, that this concept of as above so below, it's like a mirror of the things above repeat itself below on our surface, so to speak, on Earth, and they become our myths, so to speak. But
right.
Do you think that this information when one takes the mushroom that one can become aware of the stars above and how it looks, basically?
Well, that was actually the whole idea. And if you stumble across an Amanita muscaria mushroom when you're walking through the forest, there are these bright red balls growing on the ground that have little white patches on them that look like clouds passing in front of the sun.
Yeah.
And when you spot these mushrooms in the forest, they look like, you know, like God's sun, the sun in the sky on Earth.
Yeah.
And so you have the incarnation of God's sun on Earth in the mushroom itself. And you know, of course, we have all of this terminology for light, you know, and the sun. So we have, you know, the sun gives us light, and when you take the mushroom, it is said to bring you enlightenment, or you would discover the your connection to the sun by eating God's sun on earth, which gave you the connection to God's sun in the sky, giving you enlightenment, or the sun's light. You know, so there is definitely a tie there between the symbology of entheogens, and I, you know, I didn't go into the fertility aspects of, you know, sun worship and entheogen use. Basically, the sun was considered a mighty phallic in the sky, and the womb of the or the earth was the great mother's womb, and as rain fell, it would impregnate the womb of the mother earth, bringing all life. And many cultures believe that the plants that were endowed with the most of God's semen, the sun god, those plants became the entheogens, or the ones that were psychedelic, the ones that provided the knowledge or the enlightenment, so they had more of God's seed. And this was something that Allegro touched on, and we sort of expanded on it in our book, and looking at that as something that should be taken far more seriously than scholars throughout the 70s and 80s had bothered to look at it.
Yeah, and I myself have never tried any mushrooms, but it's quite obvious that when you read about it that it seems to be a very, you know, powerful and sometimes world-changing experience for many who try it. And of course, this this brings you to the question of how people of the olden days, or so to speak, how they would react to this. And I've even heard a few. I read a few articles actually by people who've taken it that there is a sense of a kind of a, almost a communication in the experience. Do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, I've definitely had those types of experiences myself, but you know, anything in that realm is very difficult to explain without sounding like utter nonsense just by the mere fact of trying to explain it. But, you know, there have been studies done by Harvard, like the Good Friday experiment with Rick Doblin, I believe, was who did that study, and found that there was definitely some reason to consider that there were some boundary dissolving events happening there that were suggestive of telepathy and things like that. And I've had, you know, many so-called experiences, and that the people, all people involved, were, you know, also able to consider and verify without, you know, it was clear that we were on the same page in what we were discussing, by whether by body language or words or whatever, verifying what we were experiencing internally, and able to verify the experience. You know, so I'm, you know, a lot of people like to broad brushly dismiss the notion of these things as just hallucination, but I think these types of experiences move it well beyond possible mere hallucination.
Yeah.
You know, it's something that really needs to be looked at more seriously, and I think it's kind of arrogant of our society, because if we look at all the millions of people and cultures throughout the world, throughout time, who've used these things and used them for spiritual purposes, et cetera, to just miss it as hallucination, I think, is very arrogant on our culture's part. Is that, you know, we're above all of these other cultures. They were poor, ignorant fools that didn't know a hallucination when they saw one. But at the same time, all of the people that proposed that sort of hypothesis have generally never experienced the full-blown experience that it is brought on by various entheogens.
Yeah. Why do you? I mean, do you have any ideas why you think that it has been so ferociously suppressed, this knowledge?
Well, You know, you can speculate about a lot of different things about it, but I think, you know, when it comes down to it, it comes to greed and people wanting to suppress and control other people, which was why the Catholic Church was created. And my feeling, religion in general is very suppressive and controlling, meant to suppress the mind of man unless they can learn the patterns within religion and really begin to study and break out and see the overlapping patterns and similarities in all religions, then I really think they're a suppressive dogma.
Yeah.
But I would just, in a simple term, I would probably just have to say greed. You know, wanting to control the knowledge for oneself or for financial material means.
Yeah, and does this apply to the use of industrial hemp also, you think?
Yeah, I think it does, definitely. You know, and if you look at industrial hemp, it was broadly used up until the 1920s and 1930s when Harry J. Anslinger started a propaganda campaign against industrial hemp.
Yeah.
That was competing against his interest in DuPont Company. And he stated that, you know, he created the term marijuana at that point, which was a Mexican slang term for some question if it was even the hemp plant that the name marijuana was a slang term for. But he basically created the term and created a huge fear campaign around it, and most people didn't even know that marijuana was the same plant as the one that they had been growing in their backyard, and their grandparents had been growing for many generations that clothed them and fed them for, you know, since the beginning of time.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
you know, I think there's definitely some sort of tie in there. Whenever drugs become involved, there becomes an instant pharmacratic inquisition, as we call the movie, which is, you know, it's a drug ruling inquisition. It's not, it's not what the proposed meaning of it is. Like the war on drugs, and drugs are dangerous, and they're here to protect us from the evils of drugs. If you study drugs, just about all of them, except for maybe Datura and a handful of others, are far safer than alcohol or tobacco or any of the accepted drugs.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, in fact, marijuana and mushrooms are the two safest things known in all human pharmacopoeia. The LD50 rating, which means lethal dose 50% of for mushrooms, is like 1,600 to 1, so you would have to take your body weight in mushrooms to create a toxic response. And for marijuana, you would actually have to consume 1,500 pounds within 15 minutes, which would be equivalent to close to 700 kilos within 15 minutes to have a toxic response. So it's physically impossible.
Yeah.
And yet there's all of this just ridiculous propaganda and hysteria surrounding hemp and entheogens and the drugs, and lumping them with dangerous things like cocaine and heroin and methamphetamine.
Yeah.
When they should in no way be associated at all.
Yeah.
We got
just about 1 minute left here.
Okay.
So, I mean, for the listeners, the book, is it available through your website, or how can we get it?
The book is available on our website, as well as Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
Yeah.
Or directly through our publisher, TheBookTree.com.
All right.
And so those are various different sources, and if people want to get an autographed copy from us, they can contact us through the website. I'm currently out of copies of the book, but I plan on getting more soon.
Oh, great. Okay. Thank you so much for coming on. It's been really great.
Well, thank you for having me on, Henrik.
Yeah.
And, much appreciated.
Yeah, great.
Good luck with your show.
Yeah, thank you, and good luck with the book, and we'll say goodbye there, okay? Thank you very much for coming on. Thank you.
Thank you.
And to all my listeners out there, we will continue next week. You have been listening to Red Ice Radio. Don't forget the website, red-ice.net. Thank you very much. We'll be talking next week. Bye-bye.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a Service to Others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.